December 19th, 1986, Cusco.
And here is where the Inca Manco Capac sank his golden rod,
the giant white guinea pig in the rainbow-striped poncho declared, looking like Mr. Rat and Mr. Mole's Peruvian cousin from some unpublished Rackham illustration. She pointed to the cobblestones near an old colonial fountain.
Snickers and repetitions of Golden Rod echoed across the Plaza de Armas, the old heart of the Incan Empire and the new heart of tourism in Cusco. Howard couldn't figure out whether Peruvians had a thing for dick jokes or were just less uptight than New Yorkers, probably a little of both.
Two churches and a larger cathedral dominated the plaza, the little Iglesia del Triunfo, the larger Iglesia de la Compañía de Jesús, and the huge brownstone Cathedral de Santo Domingo. Howard watched Father Squid and Archbishop Fitzmaurice slip inside the Gothic facade of the last, still chatting convivially. Howard wasn't much for church, cathedral ceilings notwithstanding. But the morning walking tour of the plaza had sounded like a good way to stretch his legs after the flight, and yet another set of awkwardly pushed-together beds back at the last hotel. Howard missed his bed back home. When he was a teenager, still having his growth spurt and not knowing how tall he was going to get, his old friend Cheetah had helped him cobble it together from a couple of brass bed frames. Cheetah had also gotten him into breaking and entry. Howard had paid for those bed frames eventually, getting his first honest job as security for Mr. Musso. Musso's furniture was long dead and Mr. Musso along with it. Howard didn't know what had happened with Cheetah. They'd grown apart in more than one sense. When you passed 6.5 feet tall, you started to get used to owning the airspace around your head, even in Jokertown. At 9 feet, the only people Howard was used to seeing at eye level were Tree, Gargantua, and occasionally the floater, depending on his altitude at the moment. In the Plaza de Armas, what was floating around Howard's head were more butterflies, part of the same seasonal migrations as in Lima. Tourists ran about taking pictures of them, and also, incidentally, of him. Howard tried to be good-humored about it. But walking around the plaza was also a good way to see his fellow jokers. Howard had an eye for security and also had a strong knowledge of the possible jokers folks could draw. While there were a fair number of jokers present, they reminded him of the staff at the funhouse. The guinea pig tour guide was well-groomed, her white hair obviously shampooed and styled, her teeth freshly clipped. A man with jaguar spots, fur, fangs, claws, and a stubby half-grown tail stood in the shade of a tree, giving an expert performance tossing butterfly sticks. A two-headed llama acted as a barker for a stand selling fruit cups, one head crying out in a woman's voice, the other a man's. Both wore headbands with red felt reindeer antlers, it being the week before Christmas. And, near the fountain, a group of assorted joker musicians in Santa hats alternated between international holiday tunes and traditional Andean flute music. Instead of the expected satyr playing the panpipes, they included a golden-skinned wood nymph whose flutes were her own fingers. A bronze-scaled serpent woman danced beside her, her scales chiming like bells. The less-than-presentable local jokers had either been removed by the police or been paid to be elsewhere by local businesses. Howard did not know which.
"Señores y señoritas," the giant guinea pig cried, "please turn your attention to the square. The first of our folk dances shall be La Yamarada, the dance of the llama herders."
Excepting the two-headed llama joker, who had a head at each end like the push-me-pull-you from Dr. Doolittle, the dancers were all gnats, dressed in traditional folk costumes. Their pants and skirts were russet, their shirts and blouses were gold, and their sashes in the gaudy, clashing serape colors most Peruvian weavers seemed to favor. Their triangular hats looked somewhere between Masonic ritual headdresses, tea cozies, and Howard's gnat grandma Mueller's favorite fringed lampshade. A couple of pom-poms decorated the top, a felt llama cutout was stuck on the front, and for some reason, Howard couldn't fathom, a red letter U.
The music was lively, and the dance had a lot of hand-clapping, foot-stomping, and skirt-shaking to chase the llamas around the square, or at least the two-headed llama joker. He, she, or they really looked like two llamas when his, her middle was obscured by the dancing gnats. Howard wondered how she, he went to the bathroom, and hoped it did not involve a catheter. Howard purchased a fruit cup and munched on pineapple and honeydew spears and pieces of an exotic pink fruit called mame. It tasted sort of pumpkin, cherry, peach-flavored, but not really. Like all good fruits, it tasted mostly like itself. Howard ended up buying one of the football-sized beige fruits and peeling it with his nails, which were black and sharp and much straighter than his teeth. The mame had a big pit like an avocado that he tossed in the trash along with a plastic cup full of rinds. More butterflies fluttered around the bin, sipping the spilled nectar with their long tongues, still seeming to regard him with their wing-spot eyes. The next dance was more traditionally Incan, the Camiles, the dance of the witch doctors. The panpipe-fingered dryad blew a skirling tune on her finger flutes, and the witch doctors twirled around in vicuña ponchos and straw hats decorated with bows, their knapsacks swinging precariously. They unslung them from their backs, making a great show of pulling open the drawstrings and dispensing their wares. Then they ran about the square, rattling gourd maracas, attempting to peddle bundles of herbs. Dubious-looking folk charms and more gourds to those watching, especially to all the jokers present. Howard didn't know what the gourd cocktails were, but they reeked of licorice and not the good strawberry type. He watched the jaguar-spotted butterfly stick juggler purchase one with suspiciously loud and quick haggling for a local, giving over all the tips in his hat. Then he drank the brew. One by one his spots disappeared, his fur receded, his claws retracted, his fangs shrank, and even his stubby tail withdrew into his body, leaving a handsome young gnat of mestizo heritage.
"I am cured!" the former joker cried. "Estoy curado! Estoy curado!"
The Peruvian accent was thick, but Howard recognized Spanish and what he guessed was Brazilian Portuguese. While he didn't know the words, they were easy enough to guess from context. He shook his head and sighed. Howard had seen jokers cured of the wild card before. There are a lot of possible reactions. Crying was common. Fainting was another. Freaking out over body parts you no longer had or never had before happened a lot, too. But a shape-shifting ace made a great shill for miraculous wild-card cures, and many Joker tourists bought them. Nothing happened except that one woman, with scabby weeping sores and hair that writhed like wire worms, had her locks calmed down slightly. She began to cry, talking quickly to her companions in Portuguese and repeatedly touching one scabrous hand to her breasts. Howard supposed the placebo effect was good for something. He ignored the witch doctor's repeated entreaties to buy their snake oil or whatever licorice-scented potion was in their gourds. Instead, he purchased another fruit cup and listened as the band started a new tune.
"Howard, isn't it?" inquired a voice.
"What?"
Howard looked down. Coming up to just about his navel was a woman with lustrous raven hair, oversized designer sunglasses, and a rich charcoal alpaca cloak worn like moth wings over a blue watered silk sundress. One shapely but well-muscled white leg stuck out below, poised in a dancer's attitude as she craned her neck up at him, exposing an equally pale throat and a tantalizing glimpse of two small, pert breasts.
Though high quality, from Howard's vantage point and experience in Jokertown, he could still spot a wig. He mentally stripped it and the cloak away.
"Fantasy," he concluded.
"Shh," she shushed conspiratorially, one coquettish red nail to her lips.
"I'm incognito."
She pulled down her sunglasses, looking at him over the top, exposing eyes a brilliant and vivid heliotrope.
"Just call me Asta, okay?"
"Didn't you have
Tequisian lilac," she answered, "all the rage.
I adore colored contacts. She pushed her sunglasses back up. Did you see that Haitian woman? I'll have to get some in Temptress Red, too, though I believe hers are natural. Howard tipped down his own sunglasses. Same here. Asta's scarlet lips pursed in a perfect moue. I don't know why you hide them. They're your most striking feature. She glanced sideways at his crotch. One of your most striking features, anyway. I'm a little light-sensitive. Howard pushed his sunglasses back. Something I could help you with, Asta? No doubt several things, she mused flirtatiously. But for the moment, could I bother you for a lift? Your height is so much more substantial, and I was wanting to study the Sahiya. The Sahiya? Howard repeated. The dance of the doctors and lawyers, Asta explained. It's one of the Spanish dances. She gestured to the square where a new set of folk dancers were taking position, and a crowd of onlookers formed a wall of shoulders that would easily block the view of someone Asta's height. Howard had been to concerts and had girls on his shoulders before, though it had been a while. Golden Boy wasn't available? Jack's almost as much of a social butterfly as I am. Asta waved offhandedly, startling a cloud of the actual butterflies. He decided to be elsewhere, she dimpled. Besides, you're taller. Howard chuckled. I am that. He reached down, and when Asta didn't resist, placed his hands about her waist and lifted her to his right shoulder. Not the most elegant lift I've ever gotten, but certainly the highest, she observed amusedly. We'll make a danseur of you yet. That would be something, said Howard. Fantasy watched the dancers taking position. I fancy I might bring the Sahiya to the world's attention. Her legs curved tightly but expertly around Howard's shoulder. After all, the great Pavlova did the same with the Jarabe Tapatillo. Don't think I've seen that. Truly. Asta rested a delicate hand on his opposite shoulder. You've never seen the Mexican hat dance? Well, yeah. Howard felt himself blushing, which was always embarrassing since he blushed a darker green. We were just in Mexico. The Ballet Folkloricos was very nice, but it's not what it was under Hernandez's direction. And oh, there I go, being catty. I should have said it was wonderful. She squeezed his shoulder. You were there. It was wonderful, wasn't it? Yeah? Good. I trust my secret's safe with you. Fantasy's legs squeezed like Slither's coils back when Howard had taken her to see the Lizard King in Destiny. I shudder to think what would happen if I had been that candid around Jack. Howard chuckled. The Sahiya was a lot like the Mexican hat dance, meaning one of those Spanish dances with a lot of swishing skirts and flirtation, but instead of charros and girls in poblana dresses, the women had cross-dressed, masked and ponchoed as comical old Spanish doctors and lawyers. The men were costumed like Hispanic devils, with cloven-hoofed spats over their right feet, bird-clawed spats over their left, and leering yellow masks, like the jaundiced love children of Devil John Darlingfoot and the Chickenfoot Lady. The music skirled and trilled as the yellow-faced devils pranced in, waggling their masks menacingly, stomping their goat hooves and chicken feet in a lurching gait. The doctors then began waving bottles of what looked like patent medicines or maybe urine specimens at them. The lawyers brandished papers that looked like lawsuits. Then, after a bit of circling and flirtation, the women began chasing the men around the plaza. Howard didn't know what Asta thought, but from his perspective, it began to resemble nothing half so much as Sadie Hawkins' day at Jokertown High. The guinea pig cried out something in Spanish. Asta clapped her hands in delight, explaining to Howard, "The dance commemorates the work of the doctors at the ranchos of Cosniapata and the malaria epidemic there." As the doctors and lawyers chased the last of the malaria spirits away, Howard remarked, "Tacky would like this. We should—" The words died on his lips as the men switched masks, coming back with pinched white elfin faces, manes of copper curls, and three musketeers' hats, complete with ostrich plumes. Or maybe not.
The doctors and lawyers with their lawsuits and patent medicines were somewhat less successful dealing with the wild-card virus, or at least that was the interpretation Howard came up with for the folk ballet. The Takesian devils chased all the other dancers, saved the Joker MC from the square, the Sihia ended, and the musicians took a set break. Asta patted Howard's shoulder. Let's keep this our little secret. No trouble there. Asta laughed, a sound at once artless and practiced, and she slipped from his shoulder, sliding down his arm like it was a fireman's pole. She landed on her feet, resting one hand against him for support. She took it away quickly. Oh, my, she said, realizing where she'd had it. That was forward of me. Howard shrugged, looking down at her. Happens. Let me make it up by buying you lunch. Do you like street food? Howard grinned. I'll try anything once. My motto as well. Asta looked to his crotch, then to his face, then back again. Wait here. She skipped away, back in two shakes of a lamb's tail. Butterflies trailed after her, evidently as enchanted as Howard. By the time Asta got back with the food, Howard had a raging boner, but not from her dancing. He waited on the edge of the fountain, which had survived a few hundred years and could withstand several hundred pounds of Joker. They have some wonderful delicacies. Asta balanced the brown paper sacks in a couple of cups with the practiced ease of a waitress. This is mostly for you, but I assume you won't mind if I pick. She perched next to him, delicate and fairy-like, folding the paper bags into neat placemats on the edge of the fountain. Pepian de Cui, she said, opening the first container. Guinea pig with peanut sauce. She opened the second box, revealing a pile of savory-looking meat skewers on a bed of grain. And grilled llama with quinoa pilaf. I've never tried either.
I've had quinoa, Howard admitted. They've got it in the Cosmic Pumpkins health food section.
An adventurous man, Asta said admiringly. I like that. She offered him the cup. Here's something I doubt they have at the Cosmic Pumpkin, she grinned. Completely herbal and organic, I promise. The cup, like almost all cups, was too small in relation to Howard's hand. He had to hold it with his fingertips. The tea was a pleasant greenish-yellow like pale green tea, and had a couple large leaves floating in it, about the same color as his skin. He took a sip. It was bittersweet, yet pleasant, and sweeter than green tea, what people would be calling an herbal tea these days, but what Grandma Mueller had called a tisane. It's coca leaf. Asta smiled impishly and took a sip from her own cup. It's what they drink here in the Andes.
Coca leaf? Howard lowered his cup and looked at the leaves. Isn't that what cocaine comes from?
Not the only place, but the usual one. Asta laughed. The tea is made with the sweet leaves. The bitter ones have more cocaine, but the sweet are what the Andeans prefer for chewing and drinking. She waved to the tea stand. Howard saw a couple of native girls dressed in white flamenco-style dresses with more of the same green leaves embroidered around the hems and necklines. Baskets on the counter held heaps of the leaves, both dry and fresh. The styrofoam and tinsel candy canes at the corners of the stand looked almost incongruous. They say that the coca bush sprang up where a wanton woman was torn in two by her jealous lovers. Asta smiled. She became Coca Mama, the Incan spirit of health and happiness, goddess of the coca plant. She took another sip of her tea. They also say that men are not supposed to chew her leaves before they've satisfied a woman in bed. She winked at him. I think we can bend that rule just this once. Howard shifted uncomfortably.
You like folklore?
A professional weakness, she confessed. I love dance, and all the best ballets are based on folk tales. She looked down at the pile of grilled llama. I was in my second year at Juilliard when my card turned. She selected a skewer. We were rehearsing Giselle. She began to nibble the meat delicately but suggestively. I was dancing one of the willies.
The willies?
Not that sort of willy, you naughty boy. Asta nibbled her meat skewer again. Or maybe so. Give you the willies, whichever.
She laughed lightly, startling a few curious butterflies.
Willies are spirits of jilted maidens who died before their wedding day. They haunt the forest, hoping to find a man to make him dance himself to death. And I had really gotten into my role since my boyfriend had dumped me, because while I was in the corps de ballet, he was soloing as Albrecht. Asta viciously tore a chunk of llama with her small white teeth. I wanted him to want me. I wanted him to suffer, but most of all I wanted him to stop dancing. I got my wish. She gestured with her half-eaten skewer. It's been mostly good since then. She paused for reflection before admitting with a bemused pout, though if I'm partnered with a danseur, he needs to be a total Kinsey Six, absolutely gay, if I expect any dancing out of him. She glanced to Howard.
So what's your story? Like the Billy Goat's Gruff a bit much?
Yeah, but I don't think it did much with my card, Howard chuckled. When I was a kid, I had warts. Really embarrassed about them. Kids picked on me and called me Mr. Toad. Then I got the virus. I got really warty and green, too, but no one picked on me after that, though Mr. Toad stuck.
He shrugged, picking out a few llama skewers. But I'd always liked The Wind in the Willows. Had a nice copy my grandma gave me for my birthday. And I like cars, too, so I decided I was going to be the first Joker NASCAR driver. Helps when you're so tough you can walk away from any crash.
Howard sampled a skewer. He decided that llama tasted halfway between beef and lamb. Basically Peruvian shawarma. Wildcard had other plans. I just got my damn driver's license when I got my growth spurt. Howard tore into the skewers. But when I got my growth spurt, I really got my growth spurt. So goodbye, Mr. Toad. Hello, Troll.
Hello, Troll, Asta said flirtatiously. She selected a choice bit of pepillon de cuis and nibbled it without comment as the band started tuning up.
Howard finished the rest. He decided that guinea pig was good and tasted like chicken in the same way that rabbit tasted like chicken, which was basically saying it tasted like rabbit. He then felt embarrassed as he looked at the giant white guinea pig joker. She announced that the next dance would be the chunchos. The dance of the jungle folk. Asta stood up next to Howard, leaning on his shoulder as he continued to sit. Women danced across the plaza bedecked with floral wreaths like you would see at a Renaissance fair and bearing beribboned staves topped with bouquets of silk flowers. The male dancers wore feathered headdresses and were masked with comically mustachioed gnat masks. They carried walking sticks which they used to caper like a bunch of Peruvian bojangles. Then the jungle beasts came out, women in parrot-faced masks and headdresses, the feathers in many colors to match their dresses. Gnat men got up as bears and monkeys and animal-like jokers behaving like animals. The were-jaguar ace chased the guinea pig into the square, shifting as he did from full man to full jaguar, excepting he was still wearing his poncho and pants, making him look like a South American version of one of the vain tigers from Little Black Sambo, tripping over his jeans instead of turning into jaguar butter. Then the cathedral bell began to toll thunderously, sounding the hour, that being 9 in the morning. Fantasy leaned over.
"Could we go somewhere more private?"
She whispered in Howard's ear as the bell tolled.
"I'm being watched."
The final bell sounded, and Howard looked around. There were a number of people watching them, mostly gnats and a few jokers, with cameras, stealing pictures of the giant joker like they usually did, turning away to pretend they were taking pictures of the cathedral, or looking at him sheepishly when he caught them at it. That much was normal and no different for Howard than any given weekend at the Central Park Zoo. What was different were the butterflies. Clouds still fluttered around the waste bin in the fruit vendor's cart, or perched on the lip of the fountain's upper basin, stealing a drink from the overflowing water. But there were a surprising number of owl butterflies and other lepidopterans with eye-like wing spots who had them pointed at him like camera lenses. Howard looked directly at one. A moment later, the butterfly fluttered aloft as if it were nothing more than coincidence and his mind playing tricks on him.
But looking out of the corner of his eyes, behind his sunglasses, Howard noted a number of others focused on him like a sea of photographers. He got up and stretched, still watching the butterflies and moths. While some were still focused on him, most of them had their false eyes turned towards Asta. Howard had been around enough ace powers to know better than to discount something odd as coincidence rather than ascribe it to something more sinister, especially given the hooded figure he'd glimpsed amidst the kaleidoscope of butterflies over the Museo Larco. The figure who had appeared just as fantasy arrived. Howard then recalled the reaction of the butterflies to his cigar. While he did not think he could smoke enough to cover the entire Plaza de Armas, there were three churches nearby, and Catholics did like their incense and candles. "Would you like to go to morning prayers?" Howard asked. "Archbishop Fitzmaurice said he'd be giving a special holiday invocation, and Father Squid should be there, too." Asta looked like someone who did not usually do church either, but put on her best smile.
"That sounds divine."
The Catedral de Santo Domingo had grand doors as befit a cathedral, a holy water font as was to be expected, lines and lines of identically dressed nuns saying rosaries, and a bunch of incense in the air from assorted priests and altar boys swinging censers. A different bishop than Archbishop Fitzmaurice stood at the pulpit speaking more Latin than Howard could understand, but that didn't matter. What did matter was that the incense had the desired effect, and Asta's retinue of moths and butterflies were driven back. The cathedral was also connected to the little Iglesia del Triunfo, which was smaller and stuffier. For some reason, probably having to do with politically incorrect history, there was a statue of some saint killing an Inca in it. There was also a whole conflagration of votive candles before an icon of the Virgin Mary. The air was sweltering as Howard got down on his knees, then sank back on his heels to be near the same head height as Asta. She went up on point to embrace him, whispering in his ear,
"Go to the train station. Get tickets for Aguas Calientes. Tell no one. Please, I'll explain everything later." She kissed him on the cheek. "A girl's life depends on it."
Asta then stepped aside, crossed herself, slipped some money in the poor box, and took a match to light a fresh votive. Howard didn't much like churches, but he liked this one even less once he saw a few dark moths fluttering in the corners out of the range of the candles. He got up and wandered back through the connection to the main cathedral, stayed long enough for the sake of appearances, as if he'd come to hear Archbishop Fitzmaurice and Father Squid give their guest homilies. Then he slipped out through the front doors, doing his best to behave like a tourist, not certain as to what his next stop should be. A few new butterflies and moths fluttered after him, but seemed nowhere near as interested as they had when he'd had Asta on his shoulders. They became even less interested when he lit his cigar and spent a good amount of time sucking and savoring it. Fulgencio Batista had excellent taste in cigars. It lasted the stroll to the train station. Howard bought the two tickets, then sat down on the bench, glancing through the tourist brochure for Aguas Calientes, and wondering exactly what he was getting himself into. Being 9 feet tall and tough as a rhino made him worry not so much about himself, and Asta had the air of a woman whom one shouldn't worry too much about either, but the idea that some kid was in trouble, that was bad. The old brass station clock showed 10:25, 5 minutes till the 10:30 train to Aguas Calientes. Howard picked out a few lichen-mottled moths, almost camouflaged against the verdigris above the dial. A shadowy robed figure moved silently beside him. Howard started, expecting the hooded apparition he'd glimpsed among the witch moths, but it was just a nun. The Holy Sister sat down beside Howard, glanced up at him, smiled pleasantly, then turned back to the platform, humbly counting the beads of her rosary, eyes downcast. Her face was freshly scrubbed, bright and clean without a trace of makeup, and her eyes were large and brown, with the tiny pixels in the iris of high-quality theatrical contacts. Howard slipped Fantasy her ticket inside the tourist brochure, but boarded separately. The train was an old Pullman, all hand-rubbed wood, brass, and antique elegance. Howard found an empty compartment and waited. The whistle blew, the train lurched to a start, then rocked along, wheels clacking in a soothing rhythm that soon faded into the background. Outside the windows, scenery flashed by. Rocky hills with rust-colored soil, trees and shrubs in various shades of green as the train wended its way up into the Andes. The nun joined him a few minutes later, smiled, and drew the window shades. After the conductor had taken their tickets, Asta shut the door and checked the compartment for bugs. Literal bugs. Then she sat down.
"So, what's up with the butterflies?" Howard asked.
"There's an ace," Asta explained. "I guess that. Which one?" She threw up her hands in exasperation. "Hell if I know. The Mothman, the Butterfly Collector, the Lepidopterist. Pick a name."
"The Messenger in Black?"
Hortensio said that one, but it didn't make much sense. She looked puzzled. "Where the hell did you hear it?"
Howard reached into his back pocket and pulled out the pamphlet from the Museo Larco.
"Fucking folklore," Asta pronounced as she read it over. "Did everyone have their card turned when they had their nose in a book of fairy tales?"
"Well, I didn't."
"Yeah, right, troll."
Asta rolled her eyes and handed the pamphlet back.
"Who's Hortensio?" "Remember Batista's sons back in Cuba?"
"Yeah, I didn't spend much time with them."
"Well," she countered, "I did, at least with one."
She glared at Howard.
"Don't give me that look. It's not like you weren't hoping to get lucky yourself. And who knows, you just might. I like to blow off steam when I'm bored or curious or scared. And let me tell you, right now I'm fucking terrified."
The train chugged along, the wheels thrumming with the rhythm of the tracks.
"So what happened with Hortensio Batista?"
"Sex," she said simply. "Nothing to brag about from my end, certainly.
He probably did. He brags a lot.
Bragged about his family's connections with the mafia, which everyone knows about.
About how the Gambionis have cocaine connections to other drug cartels, including ones down here in Peru. And then he bragged about how some drug lord kidnapped another drug lord's little girl and is holding her for ransom, and boo-hoo, the Gambionis are either going to ice the kid or kidnap her themselves to get leverage over the first guy. They're not sure which. But in either case, they know where she is, and they're going to do it tomorrow."
"And he told you all this?"
"No."
She looked incredulous, pausing as if searching for a suitably catty reply.
"He dropped lots of hints, then passed out from too little sex and too much coke. So I went and read his files."
She shrugged. "I couldn't go to the cops, they're all corrupt. And even the ones who aren't tend to be big-picture types who won't give a damn if one little girl gets hurt, so long as it screws up the drug trade. So I decided, fuck it, I'm an ace, I can handle this, and hatch my own crazy plan. Don't judge, but I'm not too proud to say that I took a page from Alma Spreckle's playbook. I'd rather be an old man's plaything than a young man's slave. So I called this rich old guy I know and told him that I'd bang him 12 ways from Sunday when I get back to New York if he'd just arrange a private helicopter and some guards to fly me and the kid out of Peru before the Gambionis could gank her."
Asta reached under her habit and rummaged around in her dress pocket.
"I mean, look at her." She handed Howard a photograph. "She can't be more than 7, 8 at the most."
She bit her lip, blinking back tears. "I was a little girl like that once. I mean, I was in toe shoes, and I would have killed for a dress that nice. But she's just a little kid. No kid deserves to die."
Howard looked at the picture. Asta was right. The girl looked 6 or 7, maybe 8, with chubby cheeks, dark eyes, and native features. She was wearing a foofy white dress with too many crystals and sequins and too much lace, and her smile looked more forced than happy. But she was just a kid. The photographer had also used some tacky glitter effect around her, making it look like a creepy boudoir photo. Howard flipped it over. On the back was written the name Laura, and under that, Cocamama.
The goddess of the coca bush?
Code name for their operation, Asta took the photograph. Or some sick joke that the kids are going to get ripped in two. Howard shook his head.
You were going to do this all on your own?
Oh, fuck no, Asta swore. I was going to get Jack to help me. Golden Boy will not shut up about how he once kicked Juan Perón's ass. Trouble is, I was completely blanking on the fact that the man can't keep a secret to save his life, and the drug lord who nabbed Laura either is an ace or has aces working for him, one of them being this emissario negro who can spy with butterflies and moths. And what's worse, there's this scary-ass poison dart frog Joker Ace assassin they've got called Curare. And that's more than I'd want to tangle with solo, so I've been dancing as fast as I can to find a replacement I can trust.
And you pick me.
It was either you or the Harlem Hammer. Asta shrugged. And while I've got nothing against bald black guys, so far as I know, Mordecai is a happily married man. I'm not a homewrecker. She grimaced. And even if I were, I know better than to get in the crosshairs of a lady from Harlem.
But bald green guys?
Howard, Asta confessed, you've been on my radar since I saw you in the audience when I was dancing Coppelia, and I'm scared now, and it's a long train ride to Aguas Calientes.
You realize you're wearing a nun's habit.
Are you Catholic?
No.
Good, she grinned. Neither am I. She began to unbutton his fly. Oh, my! I see you're not Jewish, either. She paused, then touched him with her small hand. Howard ached. This was the awful moment. His penis, while green, was proportional, but that meant it was over a foot long, warts and all. It looked more like an English cucumber than something that belonged on a human being. The mere sight had turned nights with women he liked into, "It's not you, it's me." And another night alone.
You know, Asta said the dreaded words, I doubt I can take all of this.
She stroked the shaft, but I'm certainly willing to try. She grinned wider. Have you ever seen the Dance of the Willies?
No.
Philistine, she chided, that needs to be corrected. Asta went up on point. Howard already was. December 19th, 1986, Aguas Calientes. Asta had shed the nun's habit and the alpaca cloak. Her dress underneath was cerulean blue, as was her hair, clipped short like Annie Lennox's. Her eyes were the same ultramarine, bright as a Byzantine icon's. While Howard hadn't checked to see if they were contacts, they matched, making her look like a water nymph. This was only appropriate since she had said she was going to be dancing the part of Undine from the ballet of the same name. The tape deck of the Jeep began blaring classical music, which was Howard's cue to not look behind himself. Instead, he made some more noise. While Golden Boy could lift a tank over his head and was celebrated for this fact, Troll wasn't quite that strong. But Howard could flip a Chevy on its roof, and that still made a hell of a ruckus. Men ran out of the house holding guns. Then they stopped, gazing in awe and wonder as if beholding a vision of transcendent loveliness who, incidentally, they would also like to bang. Howard knew how they felt. Since they were also jamming the main doors and windows, he went around the side and kicked in a side door. It flew off its hinges with a satisfying screech. The building was two stories, and the only snap generalization Howard could make was that it had an ungodly number of butterfly collections displayed on the walls. He clenched the stub of his cigar between his teeth, sucking it, just in case any of them spontaneously came to life. But they stayed still. Trophies, mummified pets, former associates, or however the messenger in black felt about his minions. Howard loped up the stairs, ducking for the low ceiling at the top, and smashing open doors until he was rewarded with one cluttered with a number of dolls and toys, a child's four-poster bed, and a little girl sitting on it behind a woman pointing a gun at him. She pulled the hammer back, and he flung the broken door at her, slamming the gun and the woman into the wall.
A doll's head exploded, and a bullet buried itself with a shower of plaster dust as the woman slumped to the floor. The girl screamed, then continued screaming, saying something in some language that Howard didn't understand. All he knew was that it wasn't Spanish.
"It's okay," he promised. "It's going to be okay, Laura. We're getting you out of here."
When she wouldn't stop screaming, he just grabbed the bedspread and bundled her in it, pillows and dolls and all. He held the bundle of bedthings and squirming kid to his chest and barreled down the stairs and out the side door, then squeezed his eyes tight shut and stumbled towards the strains of Hans Werner Henze's orchestral score, a task made more difficult by the high-pitched screams reverberating against his ribcage. Then his forehead encountered the upper edge of the covered porch. But this was not the first time for that sort of thing by a long shot. Howard smashed through, then bellowed, "Asta, where are you?"
"Over here." Then, "Oh, fuck, it's the frog."
"Laura," croaked a voice. "Laura!"
Howard felt like he was playing some warped game of Marco Polo. He felt a hand on his leg, guiding him, but still dancing.
"Put her down here."
Howard heard the slamming of the Jeep's hatch.
"You drive. I still have to dance."
"How am I going to drive if I can't see?"
"You'll be able to see fine. Just give me a lift and don't look in the rearview mirror."
Howard did as he was told. He lifted Asta to his shoulders. She locked her legs around his neck like the old man of the sea from Sinbad. But no doubt his hotter and kinkier old lady, since she did it in reverse, her ankles locked under Howard's chin, her thighs squeezing his temples, her ass on top of his head, and the back of her skirt falling down over his eyes like a veil. He suspected this was not the usual choreography of Ondine, but Asta was a skilled enough dancer to improvise. Howard opened his eyes. He wasn't transfixed by fantasy's ace, though he could feel her shifting weight atop his head as she writhed back and forth in interpretive dance, mimicking the motions of a waterfall, the nymph of an Olympia beer sign. Howard adjusted the seat by tearing it out. The back seat fit him just fine. His foot reached the gas easily, and for the first time since high school, Mr. Toad's wild ride began in earnest. He tore down the road through the Andean jungle, the ballet score still blaring from the speakers. Asta perched atop his head.
"We're out of sight."
She dismounted by means of the roll bar into the back seat beside him.
"Drive as fast as you can."
Then something landed on the hood of the Jeep.
"Puta fea,"
croaked the giant frog, using Howard's limited Spanish vocabulary to call fantasy some variety of horror.
"Monstruo verde, deja a Laura."
The frog had large gold eyes, black skin with electric blue markings, and was the size of a boy of about 9 or so, though there were plenty of undersized adult jokers just like there were oversized ones. He was also wearing electric blue Speedos. He crawled under the windshield with elongated fingers with enlarged sticky pads, sweating milky slime from his back. Curare, the poison frog joker assassin. The joker boy slicked his fingers with frog slime and lunged, grabbing Howard's face, holding onto the windshield with his toes. The poison numbed slightly, but Howard's skin was thick and rough. His only really vulnerable point was his eyes, Howard's analog to Achilles' heel or Siegfried's shoulder. The frog must have guessed this, since a sticky tongue shot out and plastered against the right lens of his oversized sunglasses. The tongue retracted. Howard's croakies fought back. The neoprene strap he'd had custom fit at a New Jersey surf shop to keep mental patients from trying the same trick. Howard considered it a wise investment. Then the lens popped out. Curare reached for Howard with his poison-slicked fingers. Howard jammed his knees against the steering wheel and grabbed the sides of the windshield, tearing it off. He threw it beside the road, the frog still on it as they sped away.
"Juan,"
cried a girl's voice behind Howard, followed by the sound of sobbing.
"Cállate, pinche putita tonta,"
Asta snarled.
Tu amigo La Rana se fue. Te estamos tomando a América. Y tienes todas las muñecas. Y cosas que quieres. Y todo lo que tienes que hacer es fabricar cocaína para el señor Fuch. ¿De acuerdo?
No lo entiendo.
The girl cried plaintively.
No lo entiendo.
Then she said something else in some language that was clearly not Spanish.
Fuck! Asta swore. She doesn't even speak Spanish.
What did she say? Howard asked, still driving. What did you say?
She said she doesn't speak Spanish.
Asta viciously popped the tape from the tape deck, abruptly silencing the Ondine concerto.
I told her we'd take her to America. She wouldn't have to worry about being kidnapped, and a nice old man would give her a place to live.
Is that all? Howard was pretty sure he'd heard Asta call the kid a little whore.
Yeah, Asta snapped. I skipped the bit about promising Kian blowjobs if he paid for boarding school, but...
Oh, no, you don't, Asta cried. Next thing there came a stinging slap and more crying. Then Asta produced a pair of handcuffs and cuffed the kid to the roll bar. Howard was not surprised that Asta had handcuffs, but the rest... Is that really necessary? She's a kid.
Would you rather have her jump out of a moving car?
Howard wasn't certain right now what he would rather have happen. He gunned the engine and raced up the road through the jungle which Asta had pointed out earlier. Why didn't your ace work on Frog Boy?
Doesn't work on boys, Asta replied automatically. Only men. Probably hasn't gone through puberty yet.
Howard gasped. That was another kid?
Or he's gay. Or that was a girl frog. I mean, Kirari could be a girl's name, too.
Yeah, but Juan?
Maybe it's like a girl called Johnny, Asta speculated plaintively. The Water Boys? I've danced to that.
It was a good song, but a bad lie. I just threw a kid from the car?
Oh, what does it matter?
Asta screamed, exasperated.
He's still fucking poisonous. These bastards sell drugs. You think they'd think twice about using a kid as an assassin?
She had a point, but not one that Howard wanted to concede. He didn't want to hurt a kid, and pray that he hadn't. Then the girl cried out,
Juan! Juan!
Rita of the Impossibles, or one of Archbishop Fitzmaurice's other potential patron saints of wild cards, must have been listening. Howard saw a flashing figure leap from tree to tree, a swatch of black shadows and blue sky, perfectly camouflaged when clinging to the canopy, but visible when he crisscrossed over the roadway, the Frog Boy, leaping with the incredible jumping power of a tree frog, but scaled to human size. Physically impossible by the square cube law, of course, but like Peregrine's flight, that went out the window when the wild card entered the picture. Butterflies fluttered through the canopy as well, moths disturbed from the bark as the human tree frog leapt from branch to branch, a gathering army. And visible among that army was its general, a shadowy figure like a wraith that formed for an instant wherever a coven of witch moths gathered together. The jeep came out of the jungle into the dazzling brilliance above the tree line and the panoramic view of the valley. Climbing up the mountain to Machu Picchu, ancient citadel of the Incas. Howard squinted against the glare, half of his sunglasses missing. If it were some other time, Howard would have liked to stop and take pictures, admire the grandeur of the long-fallen fortress city, the gray stone of its walls and battlements, and the green grass of its squares and avenues. But as it stood, only one sight mattered. A helicopter waited in the central plaza, three figures beside it.
There! Asta pointed. Fuch sent them!
Howard was wondering who this Fuch was, since he hadn't asked Asta anything about her patron, only assuming it was some ballet angel she'd met on the casting couch, and it's not like he had any call to be judging about that. But the sobbing girl was another matter.
Por favor, déjenme ir.
She begged as Howard pulled the jeep to a stop.
Por favor.
Asta rolled her eyes. Now she speaks Spanish.
No lo entiendo.
Give her a break, Howard said. She's been through a lot.
He turned to the girl. "It's okay, honey," he told Laura, wiping the tears from her cheeks as gently as he could with his rough hands. "It's okay." The tears pooled on his finger but refused to go away, crystallizing in an instant. In the cracks between the warts, his finger felt slightly numb. Howard looked down. It wasn't sequins that covered the girl's dress, but frozen tears. The back of the Jeep was awash with them, like the ones cried by the good sister in Toads and Diamonds. Howard then lifted the tear on his finger and touched it to his tongue. It tasted bittersweet and slightly ethereal, but a numbness spread out from where his tongue touched it. Not diamonds. Crystals of rock cocaine.
"She's Coca Mama," Howard realized. "That's not just a code name. That's her ace."
"So I lied," Asta shrugged. "Most of what I told you is still true. She's not a drug lord's daughter, but she was stolen from the Gambioni's associates, and if they couldn't get her back, they were willing to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. And if they did get her back, they were going to lock her in a dungeon to spin straw into gold or turn sugar into cocaine or some other fairy tale shit. We still rescued her."
"Maybe," Howard allowed. "But who the fuck's this Mr. Fook? Another drug lord?"
"He's a wise investor with a diversified portfolio," Asta explained diplomatically, "and he takes good care of his people. Laura won't want for anything, and neither will you," she grinned. "Kian can be particularly grateful, especially if you have special talents."
Howard remained unconvinced, so Asta added, "Listen, when I called Kian from Cuba, he was horrified that the Gambionis were thinking of killing such a talented little girl just because they were pissed that some ace ganked a bunch of their boys to steal her." Asta uncuffed Laura from the roll bar, "and I wasn't making that shit up about El Emisario Negro and the assassin frog. Bunch of mafiosos started bleeding out of the eyes after getting stung by some damn caterpillars." Asta clapped the handcuff to her own wrist. Hortensia was scared spitless. The air about the girl sparkled like a cloud of glitter, and she put her hand on Asta.
"None of that!"
Asta slapped the child. "I've done more coke than you can dish out, sugar." Laura began to cry, cocaine diamonds raining to the grass.
"Let her go," Howard growled.
"What, and leave her here with killers and assassins? I don't think so." Asta looked bemused. "I take it you're really not interested in joining Kian's organization?"
"Looks that way."
"Not even if we're still occasionally fuck buddies?"
Howard was tempted, if for the barest second, but still felt bad about that.
"No."
"Your loss," Asta sighed, "but I was afraid you'd say that. Jack's a blabbermouth and a Boy Scout, too, but his biggest problem is that he's invulnerable." Asta smiled bemusedly. "You're not." She raised her free hand in a theatrical gesture.
"Ladies?"
There was the sound of guns cocking. Howard looked past Asta to see a trio of Asian women bearing high-caliber rifles. Elephant guns more than capable of bringing down an elephant, and easily able to deal with a rhino. Or a troll. Sound also issued from the helicopter, an overfamiliar holiday tune, Tchaikovsky's Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy from the Nutcracker Suite. Asta went up on point. "Oh, well," she remarked as Howard became stricken, "I'd hoped to bring Kian a pet troll for Christmas, too. I guess he'll just have to make do with a magic crack whore." She danced around the girl, pulling Laura up by the handcuffs, forcing her to stand on tiptoe. "Practice, dear, practice. You'll never be a ballerina if you don't do your stretches." Laura cried as she was dragged towards the helicopter, trailing cocaine diamonds like breadcrumbs. Asta paused, letting the girl rest as she demonstrated how to do a dramatic kick. That was a mistake. Laura kicked her in the shins, hard. Asta stumbled. Howard wrenched his gaze away, hitting around behind the Jeep just as the Asian trio let loose with their elephant guns.
Bullets ripped into the side of the car. "Dumas! Dumas!" Asta shouted in what Howard guessed was Vietnamese as the tinkling bells of Tchaikovsky's Celesta became tripled in volume. He looked under the car, seeing five pairs of women's feet getting into the helicopter. Asta's feet were immediately recognizable and anything but beautiful. They were twisted, as bruised and ugly as her soul. The whoop-whoop-whoop of helicopter rotors began, dirt and cocaine crystals blowing in all directions, moths and butterflies being blown as well, as a great migration of dozens of species sacrificed themselves to the blades in a vain attempt to stop the helicopter from ascending. It rose nonetheless, and Howard did as well, dodging as one of the gunwomen took another shot. The grass exploded inches behind him, then a flash of lapis and jet hurtled through the air, Curare landing on the side of the helicopter. The frog boy smeared his elongated fingers across the face of the gunwoman hanging out of the left door. She froze, as paralyzed as Howard when he'd seen Asta's dance. Howard saw his chance. Ducking low to avoid the rotors of the rising helicopter, he ran, then jumped, catching the left skid. He hauled himself up, grabbing the paralyzed gunwoman and tossing her aside. This ended up being into the rotors as the helicopter tilted, weighed down by several hundred pounds of Joker. An explosion of gore spattered the ground. He tore open the door, slamming his fist across the cabin into the other gunwoman, smashing her into the far wall. Asta screamed, and the girl did as well, as Howard grabbed the bench they were buckled into and tore it free, bolts shearing, and pulled them backwards out of the helicopter, falling to the plaza below, holding the bench above himself for the kid's sake at least. Howard landed like a rhino, flat on his back, the force of the fall knocking the wind out of him, the bench bouncing against his chest as Asta and Laura screamed. He didn't know how far he'd fallen. Farther than he'd ever fallen before, at least. Above him, whirling in the blue sky, he saw the helicopter, spinning higher, and thousands of moths and butterflies swarming around it as a frog jumped free. The copter was then lost within the kaleidoscope of the lepidopteran migration and tumbled out of his range of vision. A moment later, he heard an explosion, followed a minute later by the smell of burning gasoline and the burnt hair stench of 10,000 burning insects. Asta unbuckled herself from the bench, unbuckling Laura as well, dragging the girl free and limping a few steps away as the bench, now unoccupied, started to tumble away. Howard realized that he was still partially holding it with his right arm. He pushed it aside as he sat up, watching as Curare crouched on a pile of ancient rubble, clutching the gray stones with his black and electric blue fingers and toes, blinking the nictitating membranes of his great golden eyes as he watched the kaleidoscope of butterflies funnel down in a vortex, swirling down and around, taking the shape of a hooded figure. Thousands of colored wings whirled inside, forming a rainbow-colored lining, the world's most lavish living brocade, while the dark outer fabric was a mosaic of a thousand black witch moths, with an owl butterfly as the figure's face, and two great white witch moths taking the place of hands. "Forget you, Howard," Asta raved, staggering painfully. "Forget you, you fucking frog. Forget you, you whatever you are," she swore, pointing at the messenger in black. "Forget you, crack kid. I'm a fucking diva. I'm a fucking star." She attempted to go up on point but stumbled, her shins still bleeding from where Laura had kicked her. "Forget all of you!"
"Yes,"
whispered the messenger in black in a voice that was not so much a voice as the coordinated rustling of a thousand moth wings.
"Yes. Forget. That is an excellent suggestion."
It drifted towards her and opened its robes, or its illusion of robes. The black witch moths that formed the sleeves and outer draperies, floating aside like the ghost of Christmas present revealing ignorance and want. Howard could not see what the messenger in black revealed because of the angle. But whatever it was must have been terrible to behold, for Asta stared aghast, her jaw dropping open. The specter pointed to her. and the white witch moth that served it as a hand flew out and into Asta's open mouth. The ballerina gasped and choked, then fell over, motionless. The messenger in black closed its robes, turning slightly, then buzzed and whispered, the rustling of moth wings seeming to form words again, but not in any language Howard could understand. However, the message was not intended for him. Laura nodded and began to look through Asta's pockets, producing a handcuff key which she used to free herself. She gave Fantasy one more kick for good measure, then ran over and embraced Curare. Her aura sparkled with white light as the droplets of milky poison transmuted to clear crystals. The messenger in black turned to Howard, its white witch moth hands multiplying like a magician's cards, for it again had two. "Mr. Mueller," the figure whispered, spreading them wide in a gracious gesture, "I am grateful for your assistance with the recovery of my wards. And while I will not forget your transgressions, I must forgive them, for you were deceived. You acted with the best of intentions. Its false owl eyes regarded him, for the most part."
Thanks.
"I have been observing you and your companions during your passage through my domain, and I must warn you that Fantasy is not the least duplicitous of your fellows. Her motives are base, but human. There is another who does not present the same face to the world as what my pretty ones have seen. And the face behind that face I shudder to describe."
"Who?" Howard asked. "Why?"
"I dare not say, unless the eyes of that monstrous visage be drawn towards me and mine. I only give you a warning, and ask in exchange that you take Fantasy back with you. She will not remember the past day. Use your implicit honesty to weave some plausible lie to cover her misadventures. No one must suspect what has transpired here, for the protection of the children, if nothing else." Howard glanced to them, huddled together, clutching each other. "Tell them I'm sorry." The messenger turned and buzzed in the same language the girl had spoken. She nodded solemnly, then walked up, placing her arms around Howard's neck and a kiss on his cheek. His neck numbed slightly where she touched him, and his cheek tingled as he rubbed the kiss in. "When next we meet, may the circumstances be happier." With that, the messenger in black raised its arms, rising into a kaleidoscope of butterflies and moths, filling the sky in all directions, streaming away in all the colors of Lang's fairy books. Red, blue, yellow, pink, orange, crimson, lilac, and violet. Even green. Coco Mama embraced Curare, Laura hugging Juan. And then the frog boy sprang, bearing his playmate away like some Bilbon illustration for a book of Andean folk tales. Howard looked at Asta's unconscious form, still costumed as Ondine, except for the cuts on her shins and the bruises on her feet. She looked like the little mermaid after suffering the sea hag's curse of each footstep on land, feeling like she was walking on knives. He'd never felt the little mermaid deserved that, till now. December 20th, 1986, en route to La Paz. Billy Ray had located a handcuff key that unlocked the handcuffs Asta found herself in when she came to. The official story was that she'd succumbed to altitude sickness. "So what's the real story?" Digger Downs asked. The reporter had managed it so that he was seated next to Fantasy, who was seated beside Howard for this leg of the flight. "Wasn't Billy going to sit with me?" Asta asked plaintively. "He was so sympathetic."
"Yeah, but someone spilled a Bloody Mary on him," Downs told her. "Trust me, he's going to be in the restroom for a while." Howard grinned.
"Story's exactly what I told you. I ditched the tour to go up to Aguas Calientes to try the hot springs. Hotel beds have been wrecking my back. came out and found Asta wandering around in a daze with altitude sickness. In handcuffs. Fantasy glared at him. If any of that hits the papers, I'll sue.
Freedom of the press, Downs countered. Bigger question is, were they yours?
She slapped him. Downs rubbed his cheek.
Can I take that as a yes?
Asta quivered with rage. I'm the prima ballerina for the American Ballet Company. I know powerful people in New York, and I can have them squash you like a bug.
She looked a bit troubled as she said the last. Then Downs echoed, like a bug?
Asta looked more troubled, then sneezed. A dusting of iridescent white powder came out her nose, sparkling like the scales of moth wings. She reached for a tissue and began to wipe it off, mortified.
Don't you dare, she threatened. One word.
One word and I'll be out of a job, because puppies are trained on yesterday's newspapers, and you and your little Studio 54 habit? Old news, Sheila, old news.
Downs laughed.
Only thing that might make it sell is if you got into some interesting nookie. Did you two?
He waggled his finger between her and Howard.
Asta's expression went from mortified to revolted.
Me and... Oh, now you've gone from vile to simply ridiculous.
She turned to Howard and added, no offense meant, you are very kind, and I'm certain you have many stellar qualities, but simple logistics.
She shook her head, unbuckled her seatbelt, and got up and stalked towards the front of the cabin.
I'm finding Billy.
Downs peered after her. I smell there's a story here because I believe her, but I don't believe you, mate.
He glanced across the aisle to Howard. And that doesn't match up. He tapped his finger to the side of his nose. But I'm probably overthinking it. I'm guessing that Fantasy couldn't resist the all-you-can-snort Coke buffet that was Peru and went to Aguas Caliente, and while you were there, you had every guy's fantasy. And by every guy's fantasy, I mean every guy. Am I right, mate?
Maybe, Howard chuckled. But a gentleman never tells.
The Tint of Hatred Part 3 Tuesday, December 23rd, 1986, Rio. Sarah detested Rio. From her room in the Luxor Hotel on Atlantica, the city looked like a curving Miami beach, a display of gleaming, white high-rise hotels arrayed before a wide beach and gentle blue-green surf, all fading into a sun-hazed distance on either side. The majority of the junket had fulfilled their obligations quickly and were using the Rio stopover for R&R. After all, it was almost the holidays. A month on the tour had worn the idealism off most of them. Hiram Worcester had gone on a binge, eating and drinking his way through the city's myriad ristorante. The press had opted for the local cerveceria and were sampling the native beers. American dollars exchanged into handfuls of cruzados, and prices were low. The wealthier of the contingent had invested in the Brazilian gem market. There seemed to be a jewelry stall in every hotel. And yet, Sarah was aware of the reality. The standard tourist warnings were indication enough. Don't wear any jewelry on the streets. Don't get on the buses. Don't trust the taxi drivers. Be careful around children or any jokers. Don't go out alone, especially if you're a woman. If you want to keep something, lock it up or stay with it. Beware. To Rio's multitudes of poor, any tourist was rich, and the rich were fair game. And reality intruded as, bored and restless, she left the hotel that afternoon, deciding to go see Tachyon at a local clinic. She hailed one of the ubiquitous black-and-yellow VW Beetle cabs. Two blocks in from the ocean, glittering Rio turned dark, mountainous, crowded, and miserable. Through the narrow alleyways between buildings, she could glimpse the old landmark, Corcovado, the gigantic statue of Christ the Redeemer atop a central peak of the city. Corcovado was a reminder of how the wild card had devastated this country. Rio had suffered a major outbreak in 1948. The city had always been wild and poor, with a downtrodden population simmering under the veneer. The virus had let loose months of panic and violence. No one knew which disgruntled ace was responsible for Corcovado. One morning, the figure of Christ had simply changed, as if the rising sun were melting a wax figurine. Christ the Redeemer became a joker, a misshapen, hunchbacked thing. One of his outstretched arms gone completely, the other twisted around to support the distorted body. Father Squid had celebrated a mass there yesterday. 200,000 people had prayed together under the deformed statue. She told the taxi driver to take her to Santa Teresa, the old section of Rio. There, the jokers had gathered, as they had gathered in New York's Joker Town, as if taking solace in their mutual afflictions in the shadow of Corcovado. Santa Teresa had been in the warnings, too. Near Estrada de Redentor, she tapped the driver on the shoulder. "Stop here," she said. The driver said something in rapid Portuguese, then shook his head and pulled over. Sarah found that this taxi driver was no different than the rest. She'd forgotten to insist that he turn on his meter when they'd left the hotel. "Cuánto cuesta?" It was one of the few phrases she knew. "How much?" He insisted loudly that the fare was 1,000 cruzados, $40. Sarah, exasperated and tired of constant small ripoffs, argued back in English. Finally, she threw a 100-cruzado bill at him, still far more than he should have received. He took it, then drove off with a screech of tires. "Feliz Natal," he called sarcastically. "Merry Christmas." Sarah flipped him the finger. It gave her little satisfaction. She began looking for the clínica. It had rained that afternoon, the usual rainy season squall that drenched the city for a few hours and then gave way to sunshine again. Even that hadn't managed to quell the stench of Rio's antiquated sewage system. Walking up the steeply inclined street, she was pursued by fetid odors. Like the others, she walked in the center of the narrow street, moving aside only if she heard a car. She quickly felt conspicuous as the sun began to fall behind the hills. Most of those around her were jokers, or those too poor to live anywhere else. She saw none of the police patrols here that routinely swept the tourist streets. A fox-furred snout leered at her as someone jostled past. What looked to be a man-sized snail slithered along the sidewalk to her right. A twin-headed prostitute loitered in a doorway. She'd sometimes felt paranoid in Jokertown, but the intensity was nothing like she felt here. In Jokertown, she would have at least understood what the voices around her were saying. She would have known that 2 or 3 blocks over lay the relative security of Manhattan. She would have been able to call someone from a corner phone booth. Here, there was nothing. She had only a vague notion of where she was. If she disappeared, it might be hours before anyone knew she was missing. It was with distinct relief that she saw the clinic ahead and half ran to its open door. The place hadn't changed since yesterday when the press corps had visited. It was a crowded, chaotic lunacy. The clinic smelled vile, a combination of antiseptics, disease, and human waste. The floors were filthy, the equipment antiquated, the beds mere cots packed together as closely as possible. Tachyon had howled at the appearance, then had immediately thrown himself into the fray. He was still there, looking as if he'd never left.
"Boa tarde, Miss Morgenstern," he said.
His satin jacket missing, his shirt sleeves rolled halfway up his lanky arms, he was drawing a blood sample from a comatose young girl whose skin was scaled like a lizard's.
"Did you come to work or watch?"
"I thought it was a samba club." That gained her a small, weary smile.
"They can use help in back," he said. "Felicidades."
Sarah waved to Tachyon and slid between the rows of cots. Near the rear of the clinic, she halted in surprise, frowning. Her breath caught. Greg Hartman was crouched beside one of the cots. A joker sat there, bristling with stiff, barbed quills like those of a porcupine. A distinct animal musk came from the man. The senator, in hospital blues, was carefully cleaning a wound on the joker's upper arm. Despite the odor, despite the patient's appearance, Sarah could see only concern on his face as he worked. Hartman saw Sarah and smiled. "Ms. Morgenstern, hello." "Senator." He shook his head.
"You don't need to be so damn formal. It's Greg. Please."
She could see fatigue in the lines around his eyes, in the huskiness of his voice. He'd evidently been here for some time. Since Mexico, Sarah had avoided situations that might leave the two of them alone. But she'd watched him, wishing she could sort out her feelings, wishing that she didn't feel a confused liking for the man. She'd observed how he interacted with others, how he responded to them, and she wondered. Her mind told her that she may have misjudged him. Her emotions tore her in two directions at once.